The Good Men Project is a social media company that gives men a chance to share, reflect on, and learn about the defining moments of their lives. When its founder set out to collect these stories, he found that for each man he talked to, there was a point when every single one at some point woke up, looked in the mirror, and said, "I thought I knew what it meant to be a man. I thought I knew what it meant to be good. And I realize that I don't know." And so this project, with its tagline, "The Conversation No One Else Is Having," was born. It's an opportunity to lift up how men's roles are changing in modern life and to emphasize how important it is to think deeply and clearly about who they want to be when it comes to parenting, career choice, homophobia, fashion, dating, racism, all the issues of the day. The Good Men Project is about, to use the wording of our theme this month, integrity. It is their website that introduced me to one of my favorite reflections on integrity, our reading today. As Dee explained, it's a letter from F. Scott Fitzgerald to his daughter, Frances Scott Fitzgerald, who, when she grew up, became a well-regarded journalist and an important mover and shaker in the Democratic Party of her day. Her dad, whose full name was Francis Scott Key Fitzgerald, authored The Great Gatsby, among other works. He is widely regarded as one of the greatest U.S. writers of the 20th century. And while most accounts of his personal life paint the picture of a tragically dysfunctional and extremely self-centered man, it is fun to glimpse the whimsy of his private writings. "Worry about courage," he advises. "Worry about cleanliness. Worry about efficiency. Things not to worry about. Don't worry about anybody getting ahead of you. Don't worry about triumph. Don't worry about failure unless it comes through your own fault. Don't worry about mosquitoes. Don't worry about flies. Don't worry about insects in general." In addition to this being a thoughtful and quirky list, I like that Fitzgerald wanted his kid to grow up knowing certain things. Dee talks about this too in her call to gather, tackling one of the broader questions inspired by our theme of integrity. How do we help our little ones grow up with integrity, supported by the best of what we ourselves have learned? This is a rich question for anyone with children. Yet parenting is not always generative in a biological sense. Maybe because I do not have children of my own, I'm always on the lookout for examples of the diversity of ways that integrity is transmitted. There are many kinds of moments when the lessons of life can be passed from peer to peer, from uncle to grandpa, from neighbor lady to local school children. Marrying into an African family has taught me a lot about collective parenting, the idea that in an extended family or other kind of tight-knit community, all adults and older children assume responsibility for whichever young ones happen to be around. Is there a small child in front of you? Well, make sure that they've been to the bathroom. Pay for their ice cream cone. Help them up the ladder so they can go down the slide. I was raised in a white American family, and so the cultural networks I grew up in and around are somewhat different. We love our children no more or less than do those of other races and ethnicities. And of course, it's only possible to speak in generalizations about something so broad as how whole peoples relate to their young ones. But with that said, human and cultural variety is interesting to consider. I would describe my culture of origins approach to parenting and child rearing as a little more individually oriented. I've learned, for example, that in my context, it's often better to err on the side of respecting specific nuclear family rules and customs. So if one is connected to a kid, then you might do well to ask their actual parents, would you mind if I offered him a cookie? Or do you think she wants to get on the merry-go-round? There's no right or wrong answer here. It's clear there are many good and fine ways to bring up children. But a glance at the variety of ways that parenting can happen helped me expand my definition of parenthood. It made me able to see parenting as metaphorical. At some level, we are all always bringing ourselves up. Sometimes witnessing the growth process of another can illumine how it is that we are also experiencing the changes and lessons of life. My mother, with whom I often exchange poetry over email, recently sent me a fantastic poem about all of this. The reason I like it is that, while at first glance it seems to be a story about the author's daughter, if you let it sink in, then you realize that it's just as much about the mom herself. It's called To a Daughter Leaving Home, and it's written by the American Jewish poet Linda Paston, who gave up writing to concentrate on raising her family until 10 years later her husband urged her to return to poetry. She is especially interested in the anxieties that exist under the surface of everyday life, and she expresses them really well. Here is the one of hers that caught my mother's fancy. When I taught you at 8 to ride a bicycle, loping along beside you as you wobbled away on 2 round wheels, my own mouth rounding in surprise when you pulled ahead down the curved path of the park, I kept waiting for the thud of your crash as I sprinted to catch up. While you grew smaller, more breakable with distance, pumping for your life, screaming with laughter, the hair flapping behind you like a handkerchief waving goodbye. This reminds me of the time I shared with my own mother a big milestone I was reaching. She was so happy for me. She laughed and clapped her hands, congratulated me. And then she sighed and said, "Well, I guess we are growing up." Watching me grow up made her aware that even as an adult, she too was still always growing up, changing, aging, learning. Encountering this poem, I imagined that the mom from whose perspective it was written, had once ridden a bicycle away from her own mom. It caused me to read Fitzgerald's letter to his little girl in this same light. The letter to the daughter he called Scotty is actually more of a letter from the author back to the author himself. After all, what we say to others is actually one way we communicate with ourselves. That's not everything, of course. Talk, as they say, is cheap. Is the greatest measure of integrity what we say to people? Probably not. In recognition of the limits of simple speech and in promotion of the importance of how we actually behave, Unitarian Universalists often borrow from Protestant traditions the idea of valuing deeds over creeds. I, however, think that integrity is about making sure there is a deep and clear relationship between our actions and our beliefs. Otherwise, we're just armchair psychologists, making the easy mistake of thinking that we can give sound advice without ourselves having any real familiarity about the other person's position. I know I found that actually having lived experience of a situation can really change the terrain and it sure lessens my tendency to pass quick judgment. I'm not proud to admit that I've been a little guilty of this when it comes to observing how other people parent. I know I'm not the only one who does this, but I have sometimes thought from afar that I could probably handle challenges more skillfully than parents whose lives I only see in a snapshot. When I was in high school, a friend of mine, the same age, who was already parenting a toddler, and pretty well, I might add, confided in me that her son's habit of squawking uncontrollably every time she tried to get an errand done on the bus was causing her a lot of frustration. Even though I was interested and full of sympathy, I remember thinking vaguely that maybe she should have a snack handy or rearrange nap time. How hard could it really be to just fix that problem? That's helpful advice, right? Fast forward to a few years ago when my toddler niece came to live with me. Getting to spend a couple years in that kind of close contact with her is hands down one of the highlights of my life. Yet I found that bringing up a kid day in and day out, here's a newsflash, I'm glad you're sitting down, it's challenging. And it's hard in a way that I just didn't get when I was in high school and didn't have a child at home. So here's the best, by which I mean worst, example of me achieving total meltdown. My partner, Amy, had our niece signed up to play soccer in one of those little kid leagues where the grown-ups have to stand on the sideline to help remind the kids which direction they're supposed to be running. And then when people get too tired, everyone gets orange slices. It's not really Olympic training standards, but it's awfully adorable. So we wake up one Saturday morning. I pour my coffee and sit down to start the next day's sermon. I have 24 hours. I got to come up with something meaningful. And I realize that we have a soccer game. It's starting in 15 minutes. So we jump into the car. No one has had breakfast. My mother-in-law wrestles on the cleats and shin guards while we're en route. And somehow I get elected to hop out of the barely stopped car with my niece and dash to join the team while Amy and her mom find parking. Halfway across the huge grassy expanse in between the soccer game and the parking lot, we get caught in a swamp. That's life in Florida for you. And I lose my flip-flop in the muck. I also lose my mind a little because I'm tired and I'm stressed out. And I start shrieking, "My flip-flop! Oh my God, my flip-flop!" My niece gets upset that I'm upset, and she dives headfirst into the bog to try with her own tiny hands to find my flip. Gripped by a wholly unrealistic terror that she is going to get sucked into quicksand, and I will be forced to explain to my partner and mother-in-law that I have lost her forever. I do what any reasonable person would do. I burst into tears and yell at her until a random mom, who I imagine saw this whole scenario play out, approaches us. And she reaches for my niece's arm and kind of extracts her, filthy, still without my flip. And she says very kindly to me, "Why don't I take her over to the field while you have a moment to yourself?" It was not my finest hour. I don't mean to make light of how scary it can be for a child to be hollered at like that, and it's important to me that you know that once I'd calmed down, I apologized directly to her, and being the big-hearted sweetie that she is, she forgave me. I'm still embarrassed that I lost my cool, and I will never live this down in my family, let me tell you. Even now, my niece still sometimes says with a reminiscent smile, "Remember how we never found your flip?" Yes, I do. And I also remember when I thought that possessing logic was all that was necessary to dispense parenting know-how. I can't help but compare my attitude now, which is that at least I had the integrity to say I was sorry and try to learn from the situation, to my high school self, who thought that I knew so much about child rearing because I occasionally babysat. The whole incident made me a lot less likely to offer advice about situations with which I have not had direct and sustained experience. Poking around on the Good Men Project website, where I first read Fitzgerald's letter to his daughter, it got me thinking. Maybe another fun idea would be called the Good Advice Project. Its rule of thumb would be that advice may only be offered if the giver has already or could realistically imagine incorporating their advice into their own life. Otherwise, it's too short on integrity to be helpful. For me, the important questions of integrity, like how to embody it ourselves and how to encourage it in others of any age, boil down to the level of care and fidelity we bring to them. F. Scott Fitzgerald, imperfect as he was, modeled this practice well when he wrote to his kid at camp, because he took the time to discern which things were worth thinking about and which things weren't, and to ask himself, what am I really aiming at?